Welcome to Frank Reactions, the show where we help you profit from the digital era through better customer experiences online and off. My name is Tema Frank. Today's interview is going to be great for marketing research geeks out there. I'm chatting with Dan Weber, the founder of a company called iTrax, about how mobile is shaking up the marketing research world and about some of the applications and approaches that are being tried for mobile market research. Before we get into the interview, though, I do just want to give you a little jargon alert because some of it did pop up in the interview. At one point fairly early, Dan refers to CATI, which stands for computer-assisted telephone interviewing, which is the automated scripts that basically get fed to market researchers who telephone you to remind them and make sure they're asking the correct questions and the standard questions in the standard order. Ensures consistency and then helps do with the analysis. So it's pretty standard in the marketing research world. Second jargon bit was ethnographer and ethnography. And my apologies if you already know this stuff. I'm not trying to talk down to anyone, but not everybody does know these terms. So ethnography is basically the opportunity to go with people and watch them in the wild, so to speak. Ethnographers will do things like go and spend time in a customer's home and watch what they do and how they use certain products in the home. So it's a way of really getting up close and personal and finding out how people really use something in their everyday environment. And the third bit of jargon that came in there was a reference to HIPAA, not hippo. HIPAA is the Health Insurance Portability Act in the United States. And it has a privacy rule to keep patient information confidential. We have something similar in Canada, and I'm sure most countries probably do too. At the end of this interview, Dan turned the tables on me and asked me what my new book is about. I was going to edit that out, but then I realized I keep talking about the book on this show, but I haven't really given you a capsule summary. So if you stay tuned to the end, you'll find out what the book's about. If you don't stay tuned to the end, but do want to find out more about the book, then just go sign up for the PeopleShock Insiders list at http://bit.ly/PeopleShockFirst. All written out as words, no spaces. People who are on that list will get sneak peeks at parts of the book. They will get bonus materials that will help you manage your business better and improve customer experiences that you're offering. And you'll get invited to the launch party. So now let's head to the interview and I'll chat with you briefly at the end of it.
I have an environmental studies degree, which has nothing to do with market research. Worked for a small consulting firm that did environmental work related to mines. And there's a socioeconomic kind of impact assessment as part of that contract. And when the environmental stuff dried up, I was just out of school, my boss said, you know, I can either lay you off or you can program CATI surveys for me because we have to interview all these talent folks around these mines and get their opinion on development of a new mine. So I got into programming CATI surveys very early on, and I enjoyed the market research side of the business more than the environmental work.
Mm-hmm.
The internet was just kind of really starting to make an impact in the research arena. And I said, kind of talked to my boss about, you know, I think we should consider doing some of this stuff online and, you know, remote areas up north and everything. And he kind of just said, well, you know, get back to work. And I kind of pitched the idea to my wife, and she graciously said yes. And so we went down that path, and my wife and I have been business partners since. And we originally started doing programming for more complex quantitative aspects, like the discrete choice and conjoint model, because there wasn't really any of the standard tools to develop that back then, so you'd almost have to custom design these, but then kind of morphed into the qual side of things.
Yeah, and I remember back in my early days with Web Mystery Shoppers, some of what you guys were doing in the early 2000s was similar in some ways. Similar types of blending qualitative and quantitative, really.
Right.
Your company now has started moving a little bit more into things like mobile research. And I know that as someone who's, you know, got a bit of an ethnographer background, I like to find out how people are actually using products and services in the real world. And mobile gives us tremendous potential to find that out. So let's talk a little bit about how you can do research using mobile without the tool itself becoming too intrusive. So what are some approaches that can work?
Well, I can give you a couple of examples of where it's been applied, and I think it is expanding the scope of research and kind of awakening new areas of research that clients are discovering now. And one specifically that we just finished was for Holland America Cruise Lines.
Oh, yeah.
And they took the mobile app and went on the boats. And during their cruise, they commented on specific areas of the boat. So their cabin, the buffet, the deck, and
so these were passengers on the cruise.
Yeah, as part of, and they got a passenger credit as part of being part of this research.
Huh.
They're on holiday, so they probably have a time to do it, and I think they found it quite engaging because there were some things that they agreed upon and didn't agree upon in this study. But Holland America said, this is information we just can't get any other way. Like, you can call people back after the boat ride and get them in a room and around a table and try to talk about that, but you don't see what they're commenting on. Like, mm-hmm. they can shoot a video of their cabin, they can talk about, what they like, what they don't like, that you can see when they're happy about things, and they look at the buffet, it looks wonderful, it's beautiful. So it's just expanding the scope of qualitative research. I think it's fabulous for the industry. That's just one example. Another one, a company called Spin Master, they're a Canadian company, they sell flying toys. So these little helicopters for kids and so on. And what they do is they send their ideas or their prototypes to families. And they say, okay, well, unpackage these and have your 10-year-old try to fly this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a house, and there's a chandelier, and and it's in its real environment, and it's not the engineers that designed it trying to guess how it might perform in that environment, right?
Right.
And they said the same thing. They said, what we learn from this actual, it's kind of ethnography-based work is altogether different than something structured.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's in the real environment. So, those are just two examples. There's a large number of them that now people are kind of discovering, well, wait a second, if I do my qualitative research in the moment, will it generate different insights?
Well, and what's so cool about that second example you gave is if customers, after the fact, were willing to let them use it, some of that could make great advertising or marketing copy for their website.
Yes. Yeah. I've talked about that. I haven't seen anyone really come out and use that yet, but I always thought that would be the cheapest and easiest and most effective form of advertising available.
Yeah, exactly. The one area where I first heard about the use of video for qualitative research was in mystery shopping studies, but what bothers me about it there is you cannot be subtle going into a McDonald's or whatever and filming the interaction.
No, yeah.
I wouldn't use it for that kind of thing, but in the examples you've given, just to see how people actually use the product or experience a service in their own environment.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. One other example, waffle maker.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to see how these things were performing in the actual environments. And they said their struggle was twofold. One was getting an ethnographer to come in on the weekends, because mm-hmm. that's usually when people make waffles, and finding, the right person that wanted to work on the weekends and so on.
Right.
And then beyond that, what they found is they felt like once they were there, it wasn't necessarily the proper environment. Like, people would...
Mm-hmm.
They'd say, I'd be willing to do this when the kids are gone and when I've got the chance to clean my house up and mm-hmm. I've got everything in order, and that's when you can come in and watch me make waffles.
Mm-hmm.
But they knew deep down that's likely not the real environment.
Right.
So using this tool, you set up your iPhone and you make waffles. And I know one of the specific insights the gentleman talked about was that more attention needed to be placed on the cleaning of the, everyone knows that
right.
waffles are terrible to clean and clean these things because they get awfully messy. And
mm-hmm. from
an engineering standpoint, it provided some insights that way. So.
Cool.
Yeah.
Now, the thing about this, though, is analyzing video takes a lot of resources, both in terms of time, but even just in terms of uploading and storing and going through these videos. How can that be managed?
So that was kind of one of our major challenges. And in fact, we did things in reverse. We built a video management site before we built our mobile tool. And we got a lot of pressure from our clients. They said, you know, you're getting beat to the game here. You know, your competitors have a mobile product. We weren't convinced it was working well, but we said, you know what, that's fine. What we're going to do is we're going to accept that that's the case. We'll be second or third to market in that case. But what we need to do is really focus on the management side of things. We already have videos people are uploading.
Yep.
And they are the researchers. At that point, they're the researchers' bane because they go, I don't even want to do video because I don't know what to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we spent that, you know, I talked about the time and the effort and money building a video editing site where we employed what we're calling one-pass approach. So you watch the video, and during that video, you can tag.
Mm-hmm.
And then very easily just drag and drop those clips onto a film strip and save it. So
nice.
You don't need editing software. You know, my 12-year-old can do it. And it's just that. It doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles. Like, you can't add background sounds at this stage and even page breaks and stuff like that. It's pretty basic at the start. But purely from a research standpoint, it's being well adopted. And I've had clients say to me, you know, we have our end clients ask for these large reports, you know, the full gamut and the presentation and everything. And they said the things that are getting passed around straight to the executive are these 1 and 2 minute video compilations.
Yeah.
Here's all the positive comments about the product, here's all the negative comments, and that's what's moving around the office.
So I can totally understand that. I mean, video is so compelling. Voice of the customer is compelling. And when you've got it in a short snippet, that, of course, makes it really easy for executives and others to digest.
Now, I still believe there's major advancements that we could make on that. I think that if you can transcribe those videos.
That was my next question.
Yeah, and then have and these are in our development plan for the year, to then be able to, for instance, highlight a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
In the transcription, and it automatically pulls that tag from your video.
Ooh, cool.
Or you do a word search, and anytime it says happy, it pulls 5 or 10 seconds prior to that word.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden you type in the word happy, you have 10 places where they said it and throughout the videos, and you can pull that into into a film strip as well.
I mean, part of the challenge is there isn't really, as far as I know, any great automated transcription capability yet. Like, nothing. None of the tools I've seen are any good.
I totally agree with you. I think it's just a matter of time. I think it's, you know, in maybe in 4 or 5 years, you've got something that's pretty accurate. But
yes. The way your system works right now, could, if somebody already has a bunch of videos that have been submitted by users, could they throw those in there and use it to sort of analyze and edit them?
Absolutely.
I'm just trying to think about whether there is any way, and I guess maybe this would have to wait until there's automated transcription, because part of my ideal scenario is the sort of thing I was doing with Web Mystery Shoppers, where we were able to get the qualitative feedback, but also do some quantitative analysis with large samples of people, lots and lots of testers. I don't know how you would do that with video, unless and until you can actually search transcripts. Have you seen anything like that, or do you have any ideas on that?
You know what? I know that they are using it in volume. We have a number of customers. Like, the actual video capture element in our bulletin board is a standalone. So a number of the large research companies say, Dan, I want to capture a video qualitative answer in my survey. And so they'll actually collect 500 surveys and get one of the questions as a video answer.
Hmm.
How they're analyzing it, like, if they have our editor there, but I would, even in that capacity, I'd be like, man, you got someone, you know, we made it efficient, first pass editing and tagging and everything, but that's a lot of time. I get it. I would say it's being used sparingly, but there's a few clients that seem to love it, so I don't know how they've managed the reporting side.
What else have you seen in terms of other approaches? Is there something that could be used in a subtle way, let's say when you, if you did want to do a mystery shop type thing where you want to assess the quality of customer service somebody's getting and not be obvious?
Well, you know, short of being stealth, like a hidden camera kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
It is more difficult. Yeah, I don't know if I have the answer to that one yet. But.
And what about using mobile surveys?
Yeah, that's definitely what we're seeing happen. Our particular tool has some poll and question elements to it and so on. So it's typically a combination of call and quant when they're going out to. So they'll go and do a shopping exercise.
Yeah.
And they'll be asked, the pre-asked, you know, go buy these five items, explain to us where they were, you know, how it went and this and that. And, you know, it's funny because there's this kind of no man's land of authority and so on with respect to mystery shopping that some clients, if they go do it, and you know, and we haven't really gotten any concerns or feedback, but I expect at some point someone's going to say, hey, put that camera down and you're not allowed to do research in our store.
Right.
What we recommend is at least a letter that the participants carry that says, that describes the research and that they're a participant in the research study.
What are things that you've seen people do wrong in terms of structuring mobile studies?
They don't prepare their participants.
In what way?
In getting the app downloaded, doing a test. We've learned a lot out of this as well. You know, you can build something and then does it, well, gosh, we didn't expect people to do that. Or
What's the expression about eating your own dog food?
But it's a bit of work. Like, it's preparation and, you know, it's not difficult, but I forget one of them. We were doing either the grocery study or it was a home, some sort of study, and it was with older people, and you know, there was a lot of technical support things that we were working with, and I think had we done a little bit more advanced preparation, I think that the experience would have been better.
And what about in terms of not just how to download the app and use it, but the actual instructions to the users about, like, how specific do they need to get in terms of what they want them to film or what they want them to show?
I see varying methods. I see some moderators and clients be very specific about what they're looking at, and others that are quite opaque. They just give us your thoughts and opinions and video if you want and so on. So I can't really direct you on what is working better or not. But one thing, and that was one of the other things that my VP product development, his name is Joe Goche, he was very adamant when we were developing the app that this is as much about a delivery truck than it is a Ferrari. What people don't realize is that these are very large file sizes.
Yeah.
And that you are not necessarily dealing with connections that are ideal. You can be moving in and out of service, in and out of Wi-Fi. And so we actually spent a lot of time and reviewed the science and developed. The easiest way I can describe it is it takes the video and slices it into thousands of small parts. And as it's uploading, if it experiences any interruption, it stops there until you get back into service.
Oh, nice. So you don't have to start all over.
No. And that was, I'll be fair, that was our first experience. We said, you know, here we go. And we were watching people. We could literally, because you could see how things were working, you can almost tell, okay, this guy's on his way home from, you know, he just shot a video at work because it was a work-related study, and he was at the end of the day. And, okay, he must be on the subway because he's in and out of service and then in and out of service. And it was restarting every time. It was this massive video. And we go, and then, of course, he got home, and then it finally loaded.
Right.
And we said, we can't have that. We've got to solve this. So we've built it, actually, where it will work offline. It'll store it. And then when you get into Wi-Fi, and that's actually one of my favorite stories to tell is a fishing company that used it, and they asked the fishermen to go out to the lake with their equipment and actually fish and give feedback and ideas and everything on how their equipment was performing.
Right.
And we knew right away that some of these places were quite remote and they wouldn't have service. And so they did shoot all these videos, and once they got home, they uploaded it. And again, it was Eiffelder is an awesome, because that company said, well, this is, you can, this is the, one of the most difficult environments to even do ethnography. Like, I'm not going to hop on a boat with some of these burly guys and see how these things are working, right?
Although it'd be kind of nice on a warm summer day.
Yeah, I love fishing myself. I would have. But, yeah. So those are elements. They're not necessarily the, they're not flashy, but they, the way we've designed it, it allows people to shoot, well, actually allows them to shoot as long a video as they need, but sometimes the device determines the length of the video, right?
Right.
So, you know, if a certain device allows for a 15-minute or 20-minute video, and our arguments, or our competition that can shoot 1.5 to 2 minute videos before they recommend that's the length. And we know the reason why they're recommending that, because it'll have a greater chance of uploading if you don't have a system. But I argue you can't tell someone, show us how you bake a cake in 2 minutes time, right? You need at least, you know, that window of, you know, 15, 20 minutes to be able to describe it well.
Which brings you back to the need for the sort of thing you've developed to actually edit it. Because I think the other reason they'd want the shorter uploads is also because then they don't have to do as much editing. But you're right.
Yeah, it's probably manageable.
Yeah. But you wouldn't get the level of information. It's very cool. Can you give me some idea roughly of what the costs are like for using a tool like this?
Yeah. So what we see is typically researchers will use it for 3 days. And the design usually is the introduction day, get everyone comfortable and introduce a few questions. Most of the core work and questions and so on is done in the second day. And then part of the last day, but then use kind of the last day for wrap-up questions, probing, that type of thing. So a three-day group, and that's it's $800.
Okay. So that's not bad.
No,
and then the client is the one that's doing the analysis and editing, I presume.
Yes. Yeah. So it's all online, and you can book your own groups, and you can kind of manage that, and upload your moderator's guide and stimuli and so on.
Cool. Is there a website or video where people can go to watch a demo of this?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all on our website. Well, I can send you a link later to kind of some of the most pertinent ones.
Sure.
So that's our Overtime product. Synchronous products are chat-based focus groups. There's two. There's text chat, and then there's video. It's interesting that text chat is unique. What people, they sometimes say, well, you know, I want to see the face, and I get it, but, you know, then that's in most cases the natural progression for a researcher to go from a traditional focus group to one where they, you know, they continue to see people's faces. But I have a couple of, I'm not sure if you know a gentleman named Jeff Wolkowski, who's past president of the QRCA. He's a big proponent of chat, and he said the reason being is I can ask a question, and once I've asked that question, all 8 or 12 people can be thinking about and answering that question simultaneously.
Yeah.
I can then go back and probe on an individual basis, and they're still part of that conversation. But he says you don't realize how much data and information you get in that format.
Yeah.
Whereas in a video or a traditional group, you have to wait on each other. Right? You have to say, okay, Bob, what do you think of this? And so he challenges research to see, you know, consider this. And you know, especially in the cases where you're interviewing teens.
Yeah.
You know, that's their natural way to, you know, they got their phone out and their camera and away from it. What we're seeing, you know, some of the bigger companies like Nielsen and the big research companies that have international work, they're choosing that format primarily because of bandwidth issues in emerging markets and so on. So your group is only as good as your worst connection. So if someone's in and out and flashing, it's very distracting. There's a lot of moving parts.
Yes.
Whereas if you just want to get answers fast and rock solid and work, the text chat platform is pretty intuitive.
So for a chat thing then, would the chat participants see what the other participants are saying?
Most certainly. Yeah, it's threaded. Now, you can set up individual questions so that they are what we call uninfluenced.
Yeah.
So they must answer their question before they see everyone else's.
Right.
You know, we have polling in that as well. So people have to answer all the questions before they, you know, they say, oh, here's the result. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I could really see whether it's chat or video, but doing the mobile version of it might help with some of the more difficult to reach segments.
For sure.
People that you can't get to come in, sit in a focus group room on a Thursday night sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that could be very helpful.
The other area I forgot to mention is sensitive topic research, where anonymity is actually important or required through, you know, HIPAA or something like that.
Yes.
Like,
although with chat, you still know who's chatting.
Yeah, but we give them, this is Minnie Mouse and this is Mickey Mouse or something like that. Like,
oh, really? Okay, so they're not using their regular.
No, they're not using their regular.
It sort of reminds me, it's almost like we've come full circle back to the early days of the bulletin boards for focus groups, where they would post a question and people would comment and have chat that way. And those were very effective for, as you say, for sensitive subjects. I remember reading a study, or actually talking, listening to a researcher who had done a study in Italy about AIDS, and this was, you know, back in the 90s, and it was still a highly sensitive subject. But they found that by using that anonymous way, they were able to get really great information.
Yeah.
Very exciting to see the way this is evolving. Well, thank you for making the time. This was really, really interesting, and I think it's very important information to get out there. People need to learn about what the options are and how to do this type of research, because you can't be delivering great, consistent experiences to your customers if you don't know how they're actually using stuff in the wild.
There's good stuff, and I also described something where people sitting around a boardroom table and said, you know, the lineup at the counter was too long. And I know what too long is to myself, but you know, unless you kind of dig in sometimes, you know, and if it's long to the manager at the time, then they know they've got an issue and they can deal with it.
Although it's interesting, because I think really what does matter, in fact, is the visitor's perception of what is reasonable. I mean, I used to do that with the surveys I've done with telephone customer service. I don't ask how many seconds or how many minutes were you on hold. I ask how reasonable was the length of time. And so with a bank, people expect they're going to be stuck on hold longer than they would consider acceptable with a retail store, let's say.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I guess that's true.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Tell me about your book. I am authentically interested in it, actually. The interview's switching to you now.
Okay, sure. So the book, well, you know the title now. So the book is basically making the argument that, first of all, that customer experience is the most important competitive battlefield now. That in an age of social media, word spreads so quickly if you mess up that... Right. And also in the internet world, you can be copied. Anything you develop can be copied by others quite quickly. So the only way to have the hope of sustainable competitive advantage is with solid customer experience. But then how do you deliver that? And so I talk about what I call the three P's of promise, people, and process. So first of all, you need a promise that is inspiring and motivating both to your customers and to your staff. What you need to be clear on what it is we're trying to deliver and do here. The second part is people, and there I'm not just talking about employees and customers, but also reminding businesses that there's a whole range of other people who influence your success. So suppliers, distributors, media, regulators, taking that whole people category into consideration, and how do you motivate them? And of course, the promise feeds into that. And then the third part, which is often neglected in a lot of companies, everyone's saying we want to deliver the best in customer service or customer experience, but they often don't look back at their internal processes. And how do you look back at what do we need to change so that we can actually deliver a better experience? The great thing about process work, of course, is that as you improve your processes, you're potentially cutting costs, making your staff happier, and making your customers happier.
Right.
I've never been a huge fan of focus groups. There's no doubt they can be helpful when you're just starting your research to help you get a clearer idea of what sorts of questions you'll need to be asking as you go further into the research process. But I do think there are some pretty serious problems with people influencing each other in focus groups in a way that I think often undermines the value of that research. Nevertheless, it was very interesting to hear how focus groups are evolving online and moving into the mobile world and chat. I still think that in most cases, you're better letting people provide feedback uninfluenced by the crowd. Although I did like the way in their chat focus groups, you could at least hide everybody else's comments until each participant has answered. I still think, though, it would probably make for a fairly disjointed and jumbled kind of group experience. But maybe I'm just showing my age here. I suspect that people my children's ages would probably be quite comfortable with it. Next week, we will have my first repeat guest on the show, and I'm thrilled to be able to bring back Jay Baer. I often quote his first book, Utility, and his new book, Hug Your Haters, is also a fantastic read, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy that interview next week. Meanwhile, check out last week's episode, if you didn't hear it, with Doug Craig, where we talked about a new model of healthcare delivery and how giving staff freedom, flexibility, and some overlap in skill sets has led to happier staff, better care for patients, and lower stress for their physicians. And you can hear that if you're not subscribed. You can just go to frankreactions.com/65. And if you're not already subscribed, why not? You can sign up on iTunes or Stitcher or however you listen to podcasts. So you might want to consider that. If you want to contact me, if you've got any suggestions or feedback on the show, please do. You can always reach me by email, Tema, T-E-M as in marketing A, at frankreactions.com, on Twitter, simply at Tema Frank, on LinkedIn, etc. And as I noted at the beginning, if you'd like to get on the PeopleShock Insiders list and get all kinds of cool stuff and an invitation to the launch party, just go sign up at bit.ly/PeopleShockFirst. No spaces, all written out as words. That's all for today. I look forward to chatting with you next week. Bye.